Hello and welcome to another episode of Nonprofit Vision. This is your host, Greg Nielsen. I'm the president and CEO of Nielsen Training and Consulting. For those of you not familiar with our company, we work with nonprofits nationally, primarily in the areas of board governance, strategy, and organizational development. Thrilled to have another podcast episode today on a topic that is really timely and very important for us to address as a nonprofit sector. So today I'm thrilled to be joined by Jennifer Harris, who is the founder and president of JH Collective. And we're going to be talking about a recent article in the Chronicle, which detailed a situation around what they called fundraiser exodus, which another way to capture that would be frequent and high rates of turnover and coming turnover in the fundraising profession. So Jennifer, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for having me.
Jennifer, before we get into the meat of the topic, tell us a little bit about your background, your company, and how you work with nonprofits.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have had my own consultancy for about 8 years. I always like to say that my sort of sweet spot is at the intersection of fundraising, communications, and strategy. So I've been working on a business model that's really holistic and that was sort of a byproduct of working for about 15 years in the sector, in those spaces, in fundraising and development communications and fundraising strategy in pretty siloed environments. So what I do is work with nonprofits of all shapes and sizes. In each of those buckets, sometimes they come to me for development communications work, and then I end up bridging that work into their larger fundraising strategy. Sometimes they come to me to build the fundraising machine, and then I end up building a case and training the board. So much like your business, I believe, how you introduce yourself, I'm kind of breaking down the walls between those buckets in our field and pushing a model that's integrative and that leans and leverages on new theories around authenticity and leadership. So one of my biggest pet projects right now is around the authentic ask.
Tell us a little bit about the authentic ask before we get into the other topic.
Right. So the authentic ask is literally my baby. It was sort of born around what I observed as a lack of authenticity that existed around A, asking for money, B, how we even talk about asking for money, and C, how we operationalize it. I like to tell people that it can be the antidote to burnout and toxicity if we start to really get real with ourselves and kind of bring our call to purpose front and center. I like to say it's a method and a mindset, right? So I coach and teach people on how to bring authenticity into their daily work. But it's more than an operational sort of strategy. It's not just about tips and tools. It's a mindset that reminds us to sort of connect our why with the why behind the work in the first place, and then to bridge that with our solicitation strategies.
As anyone who listens to the podcast knows, I'm a huge proponent of blending the different aspects of nonprofit leadership. And I think that that's probably what first attracted me to your work, is that I think sometimes we have the tendency to get stuck in silos in our nonprofit, whether that's fundraising, whether that's our general leadership and management of the organization, finance, grant writing. And I like the way you talk about nonprofit leadership as a blend and an alignment between your strategy, the authenticity of your leadership, and that your fundraising and communications are not separate, but they're part of one holistic strategy to move an organization forward.
Absolutely. I mean, I like to say that I didn't pull this out of, you know, thin air. In many ways, like, authenticity can be this like pretty vague topic, but it was literally after spending, you know, close to a decade in environments that were siloed by design, right? Like, fundraising sat outside of the organization. It both literally, right? Like, the offices weren't even in the like hospital or on campus.
And you know, also, you're siloed when you don't even get an office in the building, right?
Right, right. Absolutely. When you don't even get to taste and touch and feel the mission, right? So that, I actually think that's going to contribute to our conversation shortly. So it was sort of born out of that. And then also when I started consulting And I started digging into strategic plans. And I know you do a lot of strategic planning work.
Yeah.
And I would see literally EDs create a strategy that said, it would say like marketing, programs, operations, board governance. And then it would, at the bottom would be fundraising. And my first question would always say, well, doesn't fundraising run through all of those buckets, right? Like we need fundraising systems, operations, we need development, communications, marketing, we need board training, around fundraising.
Yes.
So, 8 years ago, by default, I feel like I started to get, a doctorate, right? Like in my, I'm kidding, but a big education in how fundraising as a field is misunderstood. And it's just contributed to this innovative mindset that I'm trying to apply to my work and to my own leadership when I work with clients and my own understanding of what's possible in the future, if that makes sense.
It does. And that's actually a perfect segue to what we wanted to talk about on today's episode. And I'll try to set the scene for our listeners as best I can. But there's an article that is making its way around LinkedIn, social media, and into the nonprofit discussion nationally, and it's a conversation that's been going on for quite a while. But it talks about recent data around the number of fundraising professionals that are, for various reasons, looking to move out of the profession, leave their current organization, leave their current role. The article, which was in the Chronicle of Philanthropy, Jennifer was quoted in the article, talks about it as a quote-unquote fundraising exodus. As a coming or present crisis for the nonprofit sector. So that's what we wanted to talk about today. And as you know, on the podcast, we like to spotlight critical conversations in nonprofit leadership. So Jennifer, if you could maybe just set the scene for that article, the backdrop against which we're having this conversation.
Sure. So it was a real privilege to even have a voice in that conversation. And that happened in large part because I have been writing for the last 8 years about burnout and about turnover in a different way, which we'll come to talk about shortly. But someone who had been interviewed for the Chronicle article ceded my name graciously. She had been just following my work and said, asked if I would talk to them. And when I got on a call to be interviewed, I said straight away that I'm sure everyone is speaking to a myriad of reasons why 51% of fundraisers say they're going to leave within 2 years, that they talk about unrealistic expectations or that mismanaged metrics or poor leadership or overworked, underpaid, or, the list goes on, right? I kept saying, I'm sure that you are getting all that information. And so I don't necessarily need to speak to that. And I do believe that those are really real things, right? Like we didn't make that up.
Right. And that's a good point. I think we should definitely put on the table for folks what the article said. What were the top reasons that were highlighted in that backdrop of fundraisers leaving the profession? And you alluded to several of them.
Yeah, I think I just said like a number that were mentioned in the piece. And I would say that those are mentioned across the grid when I talk to fundraisers, right? And my call to conversation is around like one, yes, naming those things, right? Like we've got to name those things, but it is bigger than that, right? Like, because in many ways we don't move into these roles in what I call like heart-centered organizations or organizations that are designed to contribute to social change or change the lives of families and communities because of like the salary, for example, right? So when I saw in the Chronicle article and was thrilled to see the statistic that 93% of fundraisers essentially work in organizations where they have a strong belief in its mission, that contributed, and I didn't know this before I started speaking, by the way, but like that contributed a lot of insight into me that what I'm speaking to is quite valid. And my point is that when fundraisers ultimately choose to leave, it's not just the mismanaged expectations, we're overworked, underpaid, the metrics are unrealistic. It's that there is a sense, a deeper sense of betrayal. like I always tell a story about, imagine if you have, you know, cancer survivors in your family or lost someone to cancer and you're working at an organization that's designed to sort of create change in the way we prevent or detect, prevent, and treat cancer. And yet that environment is deeply toxic, right? And high pressure, and you don't feel seen or appreciated, and, right? So like, I liken that to this experience where you start to feel completely malaligned. Like you don't even feel like you can believe in the mission anymore. And then the pull to leave is much bigger than that. It's not just like, I don't like working at that place. It's that I feel a sense of, you know, disillusionment or betrayal. And now that's not the only thing, right, that happens. But I think it's a much bigger conversation. And another analogy I use, and I'd love for you to weigh in on, Greg, is that like, if you're unhappy at Amazon, right, working at Amazon, maybe you can try to get a job at Google. Like then you can get a job, you know, a job at the next big tech company, right? But when you are unhappy at an organization that embodies the mission, a mission that you fundamentally believe in, you start to lose faith, you know? And then it says what, that 30% of fundraisers are going to leave the field altogether. Like there's something bigger that's happening. And that's what I'm trying to put my finger on, you know, like what that heartache that happens. Go ahead.
I think you're absolutely right. And I'm so glad that you spotlighted that 90%+ statistic, because that jumped out at me as well when I read the article. And it was, and you're right, it's that lingering feeling that there is something deeper that we may be missing there. When you just put the two of those data points together, 90%+ of the fundraisers feeling like they are aligned, their heart is aligned with the mission, yet 51% actively contemplating leaving where they say their heart is aligned. There's something going on in this sector, something going on in these organizations that's driving these people out.
And I share my own story, and I won't take up all this podcast about that, but I still to this day say that I fundraised and worked at one of the most game-changing, transformational, powerful academic institutions in the nation. I believe fundamentally in the research being done there, the work, the faculty, all of it. It was like, I still am like, it's the best product in town. And when I left, yes, I was overworked. Yes, I didn't get a stipend that I was deserving. Yes, my job wasn't reclassified. All of these things, right? But when I left, it was not those things that I felt. I felt a sense of betrayal. I felt like heartbroken. I felt like I wasn't delivering for the faculty who I was in love with. You know, I loved them all. Their work, still to this day, their work moves me. So it's like we have a tendency, I think, in all industries, but in ours specifically, to focus on these things, right? Like these are the things. If we only paid our fundraisers more, if we let them work away from their office more, they didn't have to be at their desk, you know, if we had a better, higher functioning board, if we, you know, like we could ask all of these things, but like there is a bigger thing that I see that we aren't talking about. And that is like how to bring heart and mission back into the center of our work, and passion and purpose, and like start to see each other as like variations of ourselves. Like if there's toxicity happening here, you know, how can I be empowered to contend with it or re-relate to it? And if I can't, how can I choose to leave? I mean, these are like, they're bigger things that I think need to be addressed.
And I think you're absolutely right. I wouldn't absolutely, I don't want anyone listening to think that we minimize the potential impact of unrealistic expectations or low salary or things like that. Because those are all really valid in the profession, in the nonprofit leadership profession as a whole.
Yeah.
But I think what tells me, and I think I hear you saying the same thing, that there's a deeper issue is that high percentage of people that are looking at leaving the profession altogether. It seems to me that if it was just a bad boss or a bad organization or a bad fit in a certain position, that you would change organizations, right? Or you would move to a nonprofit across town or in a different subsector. But to leave the profession as a whole tells me that there is something hurting these individuals' hearts deeper than just those issues.
I would say both are pretty alarming statistics from a small sample, right? Like, because So let's say that you are, like I was brought into the sector, moved, called to the sector through the arts and humanities, and then fell in love with science and integrative health and humanity. And like, so there is a transition, like as we grow in the field, that you can start to, you know, align with different causes, right? But if you are job hopping chronically, you know, then also that's a symptom of something, right? Which we chatted about briefly beforehand. And I think it's about like really understanding like the distinctions between organizations and the complexities of humans in the same kind of space. Like, how do we as industry empower leaders to get to know the, you know, the unique essence of each of their staff if they have a team of like 80? You know, like depending on the size of the organization, like how can they make everyone feel safe, seen, valued, like they're creating an impact? I mean, it's really, really complex.
It is. And that's where I'd like to shift the conversation to, you know, we've talked and we've identified a lot of the issues that are driving people out of the sector, out of the profession. I'm always a big fan of looking for solutions, looking for ideas that may or may not work for different organizations. So what would it look like in this landscape if we were able to flip those statistics on their head? If we were to create environments where people want to stay in the fundraising field, people want to devote their talents, their gifts to benefiting their nonprofit organizations?
It's so interesting because I've been giving a lot of thought to this, like what does that look like? And, you know, we just chatted briefly before we jumped on this podcast about like this sort of move away from businesses focusing on occupational health and safety to physical health. Like let them go to yoga or have some yoga on the property to now psychological health and sort of well-being, if you will. And, you know, so first and foremost, I will say the only area that I've landed is that we've got to start talking about what organizational health looks like, you know, like, so we have to start painting a picture of like what organizational health looks like instead of just dysfunction. So I'm all about flipping the script, right? And using words differently. So like, yes, let's name toxicity and burnout, but what is the antidote to that? And is that, you know, how do we focus on the features of an organization that create and engender health? Interestingly enough, and related to this, I don't know if you're, do you know Adam Grant's work? He's like an organizational psychologist.
Yes, I'm familiar with it.
Yeah, I mean, he writes a lot of brilliant things, but literally recently he was on a podcast and he said the best way to start gauging whether an organization is healthy is to ask these questions. He said, is this a safe place to work? Is this a fair place to work? And can I make a dent around here, have an impact or influence others? And he said, when you're interviewing, you need to start asking questions like, tell me a story about when you felt X, like safe here, fair, or like you made an impact, like so that people could start kind of data collecting before they even take a job. And one of the things I'd love to ask your thoughts on that was like, I started thinking about young fundraisers, right? Like, so I would never have known or felt equipped to ask those questions or like, you know, what, 15, 18 years ago?
Right. No, I wouldn't either.
So is that a start? Like that we start showing people how to see the signs, right? Like, yes, I will feel safe here because yes, this is a fair place. This person told me a story about why, you know, why be like my career, you know, kind of arming them with questions to start diagnosing for themselves. Like that's something that came to mind.
It's an interesting exercise. Sometimes I'll do it with boards or with staffs during a staff retreat or a board retreat, is to see how many of these groups actively have conversations about their role in shaping the culture of the organization.
Oh my gosh, absolutely.
So you can see it when you raise that topic and you talk to staff members. You can actively see by the way they respond to questions whether they perceive that they have an active role in co-creating the culture of the organization or whether they simply experience whatever the culture is. It's very much the difference between are you actively creating it or are you just experiencing it for the positive and the negative?
Right. So you're, you know, speaking to my heart, Greg, using words like co-creation and co-action, you know, co-activity. And like, you know, I, in my holistic model, I'm always putting on the board, like individual, organization, functional, and then community and the world, right? Like, so how do we see ourselves as part of this entire experience? And before our call, I was thinking about like our role, the role of the org and the role of governing bodies to create health. Now, again, the limitations that I see are for that sort of next generation fundraiser. Like for middle managers or leaders, I feel like we can, you know, guide them towards, you know, mindful leadership training, right? Or like, you know, tools that now exist, thankfully, about how to create healthy teams and to diagnose challenges in the work environment. And then we can also bring this conversation to governing bodies, which I know, you know, AFP has been taking on, and some of the other orgs that I see online are starting to have this conversation. And my biggest concern, or well, like the Chronicle article, precisely, right? This sort of like bringing this to the forefront, where I still don't have the solution is when I think of like a young graduate who is going to enter the field, you know, wide-eyed with rose-colored glasses, like I did, you know, thirsting to change the world. And to give, how do we equip them with the tools to feel safe, a sense of justice, and a sense of, you know, influence and impact? And I'm not sure yet, because part of that's just, you know, kind of developing as a young talent, right? Like
I that comes up quite a bit in some of my leadership coaching work, and certainly retreats with boards and senior leaders is, and I use that as an example of sharing power. You know, when you have brought a new leader into the organization, whether it's a fundraiser, whether it's a grant writer, you know, whatever the role of that person is, it's unreasonable to simply expect when they walk in the door that they're going to understand that they have the autonomy to help create the culture of the organization. That's something that the CEO, the executive director, senior leaders have to empower the next generation of leaders to know that they're willing to share that power that they have.
Yeah.
Value that individual enough to trust that they, in that what they've identified in the hiring process is a person that they want to bring into the organization, not simply a set of skills.
Yeah, 100%. And I think I love that you said, like, how do you create, you know, a kind of, well, it's like a culture about creating culture, right? You said autonomy, the autonomy, how do we empower individuals to help create the culture? And I know in my talks, particularly when I recently did an authentic ask talk, there was a lot of debate around whether bringing authenticity into the culture had to happen from the top down. And I said, you know, I appreciated the sentiments that some people felt like that is how culture is set. But I think there's like microcultures. I don't know if I just made up that word, but like that, you know, as a young middleman, I was not an associate vice president, but I took my team and I said, okay, we can't control what's happening above us, below us, or around us, but we can create the way we want to feel as a unit of five. So like, what do we need? And we started talking about like, we need to feel closer to the product. So every week we went to different labs, right? Or we went to the hospital. Sometimes we had, because we wanted to feel closer to the mission, right?
Right.
So then we had some of our staff meetings offsite. So when there was toxicity around us, we're like, how do we pull ourselves out of this? Like, let's just not get into the noise. Another thing was we could look, you know, building some mantras, right? Like, change can be scary, but change can also be an opportunity. So how do we capitalize on, you know, the transition? So, you know, I have like a lot of thoughts. And to your earlier point, I think, you know, it requires agile, attentive, mindful, authentic, courageous leadership. And part of the way we're going to start doing this is through conversations like this, you and I, right? Like collecting the stories, finding ways we can change the narrative so that all members of a team can feel like they have a role in culture creation. But it's hard, right? If we have hundreds of years of cultures, different cultures around what philanthropy even is, what fundraising is. Yeah, I don't know. What are your thoughts?
No, you used a word that I love there, and it's courage, courageous leadership. Because that's, you know, that's what it takes for an executive, for a CEO, a senior leader to share that power and that ability to co-create the culture. Take some courage on that person's part. So, I mean, you know, you and I have probably both talked to senior leaders who have their own ideas of, you know, I'm just going to add an extra week of PTO, or I'm going to implement a new program of allowing everyone to work from home or have flexible work schedules. And I'm not minimizing those. Those can be great for an organization, but where do those ideas come from? Are they coming, are they emanating just from the executive suite, or is it an organizational discussion around what does health look like for our nonprofit? What are the most valuable and valued pieces of the culture for our team? Where do those ideas come from? So, I mean, it's one thing to come up with solutions, but sometimes how the solutions come to the forefront is just as important as what the solutions are.
Well, I fundamentally agree. I actually think the magic exists in the former, right? Like that. So it's funny that you literally just said that. Of course, you're like in my brain. I read a quote today that said, you don't change culture through emails and memos. You change it through relationships, one conversation at a time. And so you literally were just speaking that. And I'm like, oh my God, we're totally synchronized. But yeah, I think it's the magic is in the messy, and that, and there's discomfort, but I think, you know, the courage to show up and be seen at whatever level we're at. Like even as a young fundraiser, I remember being, you know, thirsty and unclear and in a political environment, but I was like, I'm going to show up and try to just be as authentic. I didn't know, use words like authenticity back then, but just be me, like thirsting to change the world, because that's how I felt, right? Like, of course, you know, you kind of find your place in political environments where you don't necessarily get to use your voice. But I still look back and I'm like, okay, if we can encourage young leaders to show up and be seen, like tell their stories, share how they feel, lead with their heart, know that they're not, you know that this isn't about like having a winning idea or being right. It's about growth, that like everything we do is about growth. And that's like from the board level to the executive suite to middle management down to young fundraisers. It's like really, truly about building a culture of courage and, you know, vulnerability, if you will. I'm a huge Brene Brown fan, so I'm probably saying a lot that she says if listeners pay attention. But and then the big thing, though, to your point is, okay, so how do we operationalize it? And I think part of it is in that co-action, that co-creation. Like, okay, once you listen and collect the stories and hear each other and see each other, you can then design a way of working that fuels, you know, our biggest growth together. Like my team needed to get out of the workplace. Like that's what I heard. They're like, we don't see the product. We're never in the hospital. You know, we're in this environment that feels heavy. And that's what I heard. So I was like, let's leave. That was one thing I could do. Let's leave.
Exactly. And I think that's another way to, you know, back to the beginning of the conversation where we talked about that feeling of betrayal that causes people to move on, to leave, to throw out the profession as a whole. It's harder to do that when you feel a sense of ownership that you've helped create something within that organization. You're not just part of a machine, but you've helped create the culture of the organization. That creates a different level of loyalty and a different level of ownership of what you've built.
I mean, absolutely. And imagine if you match that strong belief in the mission with a sense of like contribution and service. It's like, I love how you use the word loyalty. So like right now, we don't even really talk about, we talk about loyalty. How do we get loyal donors, right? Like that sounds so super narcissistic to me in some ways. Like how do we build loyalty in our donor base? Like how do we ensure that they give from 3 to 5, you know, one gift to 3 gifts to 5 gifts?
Even the way we define loyalty is different. I mean, in that sentence, in that example that you use, donor loyalty, we basically measure loyalty in that way by sticking around and breathing, right?
It's totally dehumanized, 100%.
you know, you're loyal if you keep coming back next year, or if your check shows up in the mail next year. Is that really loyalty? In the same way on our staffs, you know, is loyalty simply showing up for work year after year, or is loyalty something deeper of a heart connection between the individual and their role within the organization?
100%, and you're like striking all of these chords with me, of course, because I'm thinking about how, again, I often think the power of language plays a part in how we behave. I always ask, like, if we change the way we talk about fundraising, can we change the way we do it? And that, and so it's so interesting to me because you totally pointed out that, like, donor loyalty, from my perspective, was in that moment was, did they make one gift, three gifts, five gifts, right, instead of like, do they feel in relationship with, yes, with an organization or a fundraiser as a conduit to that organization? And if fundraisers are churning and burning, like, there may not actually, in fact, be loyalty, and which is why we do see, which wasn't discussed actually in the Chronicle article at a lot of length, but which is why we see like a lack of, you know, sort of consecutive donors at organizations at like the major gift levels. You know, maybe that turnover is contributing to this, a loyalty issue too. And that's something to explore.
I think we have the makings of a part two of the Chronicle.
I know. Sorry. I know. I have so many thoughts. I'm like, oh gosh. But yeah, I think, you know, I said to you at the top of the conversation that I like to address solutions too. I think there's countless solutions. I think we're just scratching the surface at like how to even talk about this, the challenges we face, the exodus, the numbers that we see in the Chronicle article are definitely giving us meat to the bones of what we all have already been witnessing that's happening, right? Like there's been sort of an elephant in the room Like we know that there's this like churn 'em and burn 'em mentality. And we know that there's high turnover and we know there's a lot of toxicity, but like, is there really, you know, so the article really, it helped me, but I would like to really push the article further to talk about, you know, what does a healthy place look like? What does a safe place look like? What does a fair place feel like? What does like it take for a fundraiser to feel like they're having an impact? And I think a lot of that's going to happen through storytelling and getting to know what other people think and feel about the work.
And I think that's a place where the nonprofit sector can and should lead. I mean, to be the sector that embraces that difficult question, that, you know, that opens the door to have those vulnerable conversations of, is this a safe place? Is this a place where I feel valued? The conversations that I'm not sure take place in any other sector.
Well, of course.
I think the nonprofit sector has the opportunity to own that. And to
oh my God. Home. Oh my gosh. I think I wrote in one article that said if there's any sector better positioned to have conversations about heart and love and safety and justice and impact,
yes,
it's ours, you know, it's ours. But right now, there is a disconnect between what we say to the world as an industry, what we say to the world and sell to the world in many ways, and how we're operating internally. And so I'd like to say that we're at a new frontier, and I'm psyched about it. And I'm so happy that people are starting to have this conversation. You as well. I'm so grateful.
Well, I think it's a critical conversation. I have thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I want to thank you for your time and joining me on the podcast today. For those who are listening, who also enjoyed the conversation, who may want to connect with you directly, if you could maybe share a little bit about your company contact information and how best for people to reach out to you.
Sure. So I write frequently on LinkedIn, so they can just find me as Jennifer Harris. And then my email is, or my website would probably be better, is JH Collective, Inc., I-N-C. So JH Collective, Collective, Inc.com. I also collect authentic asks from people who want to share their like most meaningful or most powerful ask experiences.
Oh, sometimes, I love it.
Yeah. So if people are interested in sharing positive, powerful, potent stories that like reflect the, you know, kind of magic of this work, not just the stuff that is, you know, causing us to have this conversation. I love to hear it. I love the powerful stories. I think that's medicine for a lot of us. They can email me at jennifer@jhcollectiveinc.com. And sometimes you'll see on LinkedIn, #authenticask, and it might take that me or take someone right to my work.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Jennifer, thank you again for joining me on the podcast. I have thoroughly enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you so much, Greg.
Again, this has been Greg Nielsen of Nielsen Training and Consulting. Also, love hearing from you all who are listening to the podcast. I can be reached through my website at www.nielsenconsults.com or by email at gregory@nielsenconsults.com. Thank you very much and look forward to the next episode.